You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension, a dimension of sound, a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. We are undertaking a special project today. The Christian Humanist Radio Network is doing a series of episodes, one from each show, on the Twilight Zone, much like we did last year with Firefly, albeit, I think, with a better show this time around. You're free to write in and disagree with me on that. That means we're mixing up hosts and shifting things around a little bit. Joining me today are two guests. Stolen from the Christian Humanist Behind the Scenes crew is Kristen Filipic, an employee of Leviathan, up in Boston, Massachusetts. That is, she works for Housing and Urban Development. Kristen, how are things back east?
We're doing just fine.
Excellent, excellent. And also joining us is Jay Eldred, stolen from the Sectarian Review. Jay lives in New Bern, North Carolina, where he teaches high school history. Jay, are you back east or are you down south?
Back east. So we just got the brunt of Hurricane Matthew. We're starting to dry out.
Okay, excellent. And I saw on Facebook that you guys were mostly fine, right?
Yeah, where we were was fine. About 20 minutes away, not so fine.
Right, right. Well, we're glad you were okay. But you did get out of school from that, right?
Yeah, about 2 days.
Is that like the North Carolina equivalent of a snow day?
Yes.
So do you,
instead of snow days, we have hurricane days.
Do you celebrate hurricanes then? Because when I got snow days when I was growing up, that was an awesome thing.
It depends on how severe the hurricane is, but almost everyone enjoys the pre-hurricane weather.
Reasonable enough, I think. Well, we should probably dig into it. We have three episodes from the Twilight Zone to cover today. Before we get into the individual episodes, which I suppose we should mention, the individual episodes are The Monsters Are Due on Main Street, The Encounter, and Death's Head Revisited. Each of these are from a different season, although I don't know that I remember which season they're all from. It's like 1, 3, and 5, is that right? Something along those lines. Did anyone notice any running themes through the three episodes that we should sort of be on the lookout for as we're walking through these? And we'll come back to this at the end, but just as an upfront, sort of keep our eyes open for things. I caught sort of the theme that people who we might normally think of as heroic end up being kind of awful. You know, people who maybe either in the American mind or just sort of in Western tradition generally should be standing out in terms of virtue, they end up being monsters. Did either of you guys have anything?
One thing that I noticed running throughout the three were generally man's inhumanity to other men. Our base nature tends to come out.
Yeah, sure. One thing I observed on very similar lines is that a lot of the characters who we would expect to see as heroic, we saw their darker, uglier side. But the people who we would expect to see as villains were just villains. They weren't three-dimensional in the same way. So Twilight Zone's pretty dark.
It is, and that mm-hmm. surprised me when I watched it. I mean, I'd never seen a full episode of the old Twilight Zone before. So I was sort of vaguely familiar with it, and I've seen several of the parodies, you know, the Simpsons parodies and so on. But I didn't realize how bleak a show it was. And I suppose maybe these three episodes aren't representative, but they were certainly grim enough in their own right. Well, with that, we should get into it. The Monsters Are Due on Main Street was the first of the three episodes. We're just taking these in the order that Michael Farmer assigned them to us. There's no real rhyme or reason to it beyond that. The first episode, again, is Monsters Are Due on Main Street. Spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it. The loose plot is it's, you know, Main Street America. Did I say Main Street? It's The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, right?
Yes,
it's
Maple.
Okay. At least I think the first time I wrote this down, I wrote Mulberry Street because I've been reading Dr. Seuss. So, all right, monsters are due on Maple Street. Just loosely what's going on is this is sort of any town America. The idea is this could be any street in the country. In that sense, it really could be Main Street other than it's a neighborhood. People are out, you know, washing their cars and mowing their lawns, and they see something go overhead, some kind of meteor or comet or something. People are unsure what it was. Shortly after this, the power goes out, the phones go dead, the radio goes off, all electronic devices stop working. One gentleman walks to the next street over, which is apparently several miles away because it takes him, you know, a good 8 or 9 hours to get back, finds that walks to the next street over while everyone else, over the course of the episode, get more and more suspicious of each other. Without going into too many of the nuts and bolts of the episode, One gentleman's car sort of turns on and shuts off by himself, so people start to think that he's the one responsible, and of course, once he's under suspicion, all of the idiosyncrasies that people know about him start to be thrown out at him as accusations. He has, you know, a reasonable defense for any one of them, but when you pile them all up, they start to look a little bit suspicious from the perspective of the people there. And then power starts going on in someone else's house, so suspicions turns there, and quickly people start to blame each other. I don't know if I want to say it's caused by a teenage kid, but there is a kid there who's sort of telling people that this is clearly aliens, I don't know. I guess I wasn't sure how to interpret that. Did you guys have thoughts on that kid other than that he needed to be, disciplined by his parents? I mean, is he to blame for this whole thing?
Oh, question.
I didn't think of him as particularly to blame. But almost sort of like a Tom Sawyer sort of character who is well-read in adventure stories for Tom Sawyer or science fiction for this kid and thinks in these grand traumatic terms because he typically has his head in a book.
Right, but uses it so badly.
True, certainly true.
Anyway, it was something that I was unsure what to do with him other than being generally irritated by, you know, the kid who jumps straight to clearly it's aliens who are trying to conquer us.
Right.
I struggled with that a little bit. But, you know, you got to drive the plot forward somehow, I guess.
Also true.
People start to turn on each other. Finally, the older gentleman who'd walked to the next street over to check things out on his way back gets shot by one of the neighbors. And at that point, that's sort of the point of no return. When this guy gets shot, then they start really turning on each other. A riot breaks out, and the street descends into chaos. And as the episode comes to an end, we see a couple of aliens sitting up on a hill nearby. So of course, the kid was right, I suppose. Controlling the power with whatever their little technological device is, and talking about how they can throw the entire society into chaos just by turning off the lights, and all they have to do is go around and do this to every Maple Street in the country or many of the Maple Streets, and it'll completely undercut our whole society. So I think that's sort of the loose nuts and bolts of the episode. Any major points I missed there?
Yeah,
no, that sounds good to me.
Sounds pretty good.
So obviously, several themes going on here. There's the role of technology, right? The technology as something that is obviously in some ways very much a blessing, right? These people all have electricity and they have radios and telephones and cars and so on, but also as something that reveals something very dark about human nature. Technology, when it is removed, when people have become reliant on it, becomes a stumbling block, becomes a way that we turn on each other, and ultimately doesn't provide the salvation that we maybe hope for from it. I thought it was sort of interesting to have a science fiction episode, if that's, I don't know if it's fair to completely qualify this, describe this as science fiction, but it's interesting to have a science fiction episode where technology is not painted in a particularly good light. So the technological aspect of it, I thought was sort of interesting. And of course, you have the aliens who are using technology to basically destroy Main Street America. Ah, I did it again. Maple Street America. Aliens are using technology to destroy Maple Street America. That, I think, is sort of interesting, but I think that's also kind of a side note. Much more important in this is the issue of mob mentality, right? As people who are neighbors, people who have presumably been living next to each other for years, start to turn on each other basically over nothing. And I don't think anyone watching this in the 1960s could have failed to think in terms of McCarthyism here.
Absolutely.
Which would have been more impressive had this been made, you know, a decade earlier. I think by the time you get to 1960, going after McCarthyism is fairly common. So it's not like they're doing this in 1950 when McCarthy is still at the height of his public power. But it is still clearly an interpretation of it that I think is worth paying some attention to, where fear overtakes kind of the caution and the patience that really should be the hallmark of that kind of neighborhood. When the power goes out, we shouldn't jump straight to throwing rocks and shooting at each other. We should give the benefit of the doubt. We should, you know, use common sense. We should do all of the things that we like to think that Americans are good at. Even if we don't think we're so good at that in the 21st century, certainly we think Americans coming right out of the 1950s were. And again, this episode gives us a completely different view. What do you guys think of the episode? I have a couple of more specific questions, but I'm just sort of curious. What were your thoughts on it overall?
It seemed to me to be, there is such a human need to explain the unexplainable. So they're starting off in a situation where something weird is going on, and something's kind of scary, but it is not humanly possible to just sort of leave it at that. We need to come up with some sort of explanation that makes sense, and in doing so, come up with explanations that are drastically worse than reality. But in some way, that is less scary than just leaving things unexplained.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way. Again, I thought more sort of in terms of it's okay not to know for a little while, and they're not even willing to do that. But I think you're right. I think there is that idea of we're going to just fill in the blanks, and it ends up, even though it ends up being worse, it's still preferable to not knowing at all. Yeah, that's good. I hadn't thought about that. Jay, what do you think?
I looked at it more along the lines of what happens to the us versus them mentality when there is no them. We're coming off of, you know, I still think 1960s, you know, not only is McCarthyism still fresh in everyone's mind, but so is World War II, which I know deal more with Kristen's episode and mine. We're also dealing more with the start of the Cold War as well, where Russia isn't the friendly ally we thought it was. If we're looking at late 50s, early 60s, I said we thought this episode was. So what happens when there is no them we can point at? Then it starts to be our neighbor, our friend, and it kind of reminded me of a Lord of the Flies mentality.
Yeah, that's something I was talking to the wife about after we watched this. Sort of the question of who is actually guilty here, like who's responsible for the chaos that descends on Maple Street. And I think the three options are the kid, right, who in a sense is playing a Cassandra, where he's giving these warnings, but it's a very twisted version of a Cassandra, where the warnings themselves are actually causing the very thing that he's warning them about. Obviously, you have the mob mentality, right? It may just be that the people themselves are to blame, and I think we're supposed to take that away from it. I think that's sort of the takeaway is, look, these are Americans are just as capable of doing this sort of thing as anyone else. We're just as prone to violence and to turning on each other and civil strife and so on as anyone else, and it just takes a gentle nudge to make it happen. But I also think that ultimately, at the end of the day, obviously the aliens are guilty. And I think there's an argument to be made that there are some colonialism, I suppose, isn't the right word, although, Jay, I should defer to you on this. There's some anti-imperialism or colonialism or whatever the right, you know, sort of mid-20th century word is, where you have this technological superior power coming in and intentionally disrupting a society for the purposes of causing chaos. Right. I don't necessarily think that's what the Twilight Zone creators were going for specifically with this episode, but I did think it was interesting that this was intentional on the part of the aliens. They were doing it, right, sort of striking at us where we were weakest, much like, you know, say America might have done in the middle of the 20th century in Iran or Nicaragua, or, you know, pick your country of choice that we intervened in. Other thoughts on this episode?
I'm still thinking about how the boy fits into this. I've still been mulling that over. It's almost going back to the Boy Who Cried Wolf in a way, because, I mean, you can blame the aliens in a way, but the only thing you can blame them for is turning the lights on and off. All of the actions were caused by the people, but, you know, you have this kid the whole time saying it's aliens, and, well, we know, thanks to seeing the end of the show, that yes, it is, but it's, I don't know, I think I kind of lost my train of thought there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is kind of hard to know, you know, where the multiple layers of responsibility fall, because they are all guilty, right? I mean, the aliens, they're doing this on purpose, but the people are the ones who are doing it. But the kid also, and of course he's a kid, so, you know, how much responsibility do you really have when you're however old he is, 11 or 12 or 13 or whatever, and you've been reading comic books your whole life. But I don't know. I don't know what to do with him. Other thoughts on the episode? Otherwise, we should move on.
All right. So the next one is called The Encounter. It came out in 1964, and there are only two characters in this. Mr. Fenton. I don't think we ever hear a first name for him. I think he's only just Mr. Fenton. Is of a veteran of World War II, homeowner. And the other person, Arthur Takamori, is a younger man, in his mid-20s at this point. And he comes by, he's going to be doing some gardening work around, cutting the lawn or something like that, around Fenton's house. Fenton is up in his attic trying to clear out a couple decades worth of junk, as we do from time to time. Asks if Arthur would also help with that project. And then, they're talking for a while, and the conversation generally gets more and more intense, and there's levels of hostility that nobody's quite saying, but you can feel that there's something going on, and until it turns out that they both have secrets in their past that the veteran has a traditional Japanese sword, which he took off of a Japanese soldier that he had killed in the war, and somehow this sword has a lot of power. Somehow it is cursed. It is controlling what's happening in some way that we can't ever quite understand. And the truth comes out that that our American war hero veteran had killed this Japanese soldier after the soldier was disarmed and trying to surrender. And I was looking on the internet to try to see if that's considered a war crime, and I couldn't quite see one way or the other, but it is certainly considered bad. At what level of culpability, I'm not 100% sure. Meanwhile, the Japanese young man was a preschooler when World War II broke out. So he doesn't have any actions of his own during that era. But it turns out that his father, who had also been born and raised in Hawaii, had helped guide the Japanese bombers to come into Pearl Harbor. So both of them are living with all of this, and as the their verbal sparring becomes more and more intense, it turns into a physical confrontation. Fenton ends up falling on the sword and dying, and then Arthur grabs it and jumps out the window. Presumably, I think we're supposed to understand that that's to his own death. So this, which seems a little strange. They're probably on the second or third floor, but I think we're supposed to understand that he's leaping out the window to his own death, and the show ends there. So I remember occasionally seeing Twilight Zone reruns when I was a kid in the 80s, but it turns out this one episode never went into syndication. It was originally broadcast that one time in 1964, and then nobody saw it again until just the last couple years when it was recently re-released on DVD and Netflix. Why was this particular episode pulled from syndication?
Is that like a question for us,
sure.
Or do you have it?
Yes.
I would just guess that it was too controversial showing a World War II vet in such a negative light. But I don't know. I mean,
it could also have been the portrayal, not just of the World War II vet, but, you know, bringing up old wounds. You know, we're supposed to be moving on by then. I think in the late 50s, early 60s, we're starting to, you know, trade with Japan again. So there's that economic interest. If they're supposed to be our allies, you know, should we be bringing this up again?
Sure.
And then there's also, you know, the idea of human rights, equal rights. We could bring that into it as well. I'm not sure how prevalent that would have been in the early 60s, but looking at it through the lens of 2016, we could definitely say there's some race problems there.
That's for sure.
And, I mean, it's also, sometimes when this happens with television, it's very benign. Like, you can only show so many things in a given season, even in syndication, so the good ones tend to make the cut, and the ones that people don't like as much don't. I mean, it may just be that it wasn't as popular.
Could be.
Yeah, I would say that this one doesn't strike me as one of the more memorable episodes, necessarily.
Right, I mean, if it didn't have George Takei in it, I would... It's not that it's not a good episode, it's just not that it doesn't stand out compared to the other two we watched.
Right.
One thing that struck me, especially at the beginning of the episode, is that this so seemed to fit in with all the conversations we're having now about microaggressions. Fenton makes a seemingly innocent comment, or at least he thinks it's innocent, about how it's funny that a Japanese-American would be named Arthur. He clearly bristles at that. I was born here. I'm just as much of an American as anybody else, so why would that be funny? And Fenton just says, oh, goodness, why are you so sensitive? Am I seeing this too much with 2016 eyes, or are there parallels with a lot of the conversations about subtle racism that have been swirling around just in the last couple of years?
Jay, you want to tackle that one?
I'm trying to think on how I want to answer that. I think that we could say there's some of that going on, but it could go back as well to the whole us versus them mentality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how integrated was the Asian community in 1960 or so? They may have been here while we're still coming off. Again, these episodes are airing when the Nisei are still in cultural memory, at least on the West Coast. You know, for good decades, they were forgotten by Americans in general, but I'm certain that those in California especially had a distrustful view of those of Japanese descent. And so it's almost like, okay, you're here, your family's assimilated, but how much can I actually trust you?
Well, and obviously part of the point of that conversation is to eventually reveal that his name is not actually Arthur.
That's true.
Right.
So I don't know that they would have thought in terms of microaggressions in the, you know, in the 60s, but it's also clearly intended to provoke him a little bit. It's intended to get him to eventually reveal that his name is, and I forget what his name was, Toro, right?
Yes. He was named Toro at birth and started calling himself Arthur later on.
Right. So it may be fair to talk about microaggressions in this episode, but is as part of the plot, not, I don't think, in terms of making social commentary about it.
Well, we could also talk about what it means to be fully accepted as an American, because if I'm reading the script correctly, Arthur, that's what I'll call him, Arthur's, is he a second-generation American?
At least, yeah.
At least, and he's still not, while he might be assimilated, maybe, he's definitely not accepted in society, so that says something about us.
I'm thinking about that. What do you mean by he's not accepted in society?
Well, not that necessarily that we viewing him don't accept him, but he's not accepted by, is it Felder, Felding?
Felton.
Is it Felder? Felton, thank you. He's Fenton. He's not accepted by Fenton at all. But there again, we go back to the plot of the story that Fenton wouldn't have accepted him anyway.
Right, and I'm just not sure. I'm not sure what we're supposed. I don't know enough about the 60s to assume if we're supposed to draw any conclusions by, about the fact that he's a gardener, and like what does that say something about sort of his status in the society? I don't know.
Yes, the 60s aren't my realm of expertise either.
Yeah, sorry, I don't have a good answer there, yeah. Kristen. Apparently, that was a great question because I don't know.
If any of the listeners have an idea, please let us know.
Definitely.
One thing I noticed as I was just sort of skimming around the internet to see what other people were saying about this episode is I just saw a lot of those conversations playing out, that a lot of people were saying how nothing that Fenton is saying is exactly wrong, but it's just sort of feels off, and then that grows and grows and grows. And other people were saying, my goodness, what are you talking about? Arthur is just blowing up over nothing. So it just seemed like exactly the same sorts of conversations we're having now.
Yeah, it seems like the same sorts of conversations we're having about TV shows from the 80s and 90s. And, you know, should we rewatch them? You know, is it still okay to laugh at those comedies, that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. Which I guess speaks something to the episode, because we started out saying it wasn't one that stood out in terms of Twilight Zone episodes, and yet it still says something quite a bit about the society that we live in today.
That's for sure. So we often think of World War II as the good war in our somewhat recent memory, but mm-hmm. both of these two men are carrying a lot of guilt, and I was wondering to what extent that was the appropriate sort of good guilt, or is this excessive and misplaced?
Yeah, I like that question when I saw it in the outline. It reminds me a lot of Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five.
Yes,
which is very a book about World War II, but it's about like the great Allied atrocity of World War II, mm-hmm. And something along those lines. But I think there is a difference in the guilt here. I mean, Fenton's guilt is obviously personal over something that he did himself, mm-hmm. whereas Arthur's guilt is, I guess, familial, maybe even racial, over something that his family did, and that, you know, his culture is seen as doing, or at least his ancestry is seen as doing. I think in that case, you would probably, or we could probably argue that Fenton's guilt is good in that it's good to feel bad about having done something so awful, but maybe not being dealt with in the best way. Arthur's guilt, or I don't know quite as much about how to process that, because I think families are important and the actions of our ancestors affect us, but he's also not the one who committed treason, and
right.
He's not the one who did those things. And he's obviously worked very hard to build an independent life for himself, to the point where he is he's independently employed, and he seems to have a job that is flourishing in the community and seems to have embraced the American lifestyle. So I don't know what to think about his guilt. I think those familial connections do matter, which is not to say that, you know, everything my parents have done I'm responsible for, or vice versa, but you can't ignore it completely either. And I mean, that sort of ties into a conversation that we had on the podcast a few weeks back. Should we feel guilty over something like slavery before the Civil War? Right. That is something that my ancestors were involved with in some way, but it's not anything that I personally did. Well, it's sort of the same issue. I don't think you can give a straight, solid answer to that question, at least not very easily. And it certainly wouldn't be a thoughtful answer if it's just an absolute yes or no with no reflection. And I would hesitate to say the same thing about Arthur. I don't know if that makes sense. All right, Kristen, you got to tell us, what's the right answer?
Well, I wonder maybe if it's helpful to distinguish between guilt and responsibility.
Okay.
And we were talking about slavery in particular, and I'm thinking of one couple at my church where the husband is in a one of his ancestors, however many generations back, were one of the major slave trading families in Rhode Island. And that has largely become a family project for them to be delving into that history and thinking about how do we live in response to this. And some of them feel tremendously guilty about this. And the gentleman in my parish says, you know, I don't feel guilty about it, but we do still have a responsibility to live in a way that takes this into account. And he happens to be in an interracial marriage, and he and his wife do a tremendous amount of work, in building racial dialogues and things like that, in significant part coming out of this family history. And maybe the worst result would be if we feel guilty enough that we're beating ourselves up about it, but then don't ever actually do anything. And I think that's an easy trap to end up in, and it's probably the worst of all worlds.
Yeah, and again, I am not 100% sold on the idea that we should feel guilty. I want to recognize that there is a good argument for it.
Sure,
it is not an irrational thing to do. And of course, we could also turn that around and ask, you know, if you're on the receiving end of that, should you still be outraged over it? Which is not as relevant a question for this specific episode, of course, because there's not, you know, hundreds of years in between the outrage and the people involved. But you start getting into slavery in America and so on, then that also becomes an issue. Mm-hmm. Should I still be outraged that my ancestors were driven out of Ireland by the British? Well, I don't think so. I know I have family members who are, but I think they're wrong. So, Not maybe as relevant here, because we're talking people who did the atrocity themselves, or it was, you know, Arthur's dad who did it. So not quite the same distance there.
Well, it sounds like we've already started talking about more personal mm-hmm. histories here. One thing that was impossible for me to ignore, looking back at this episode from 50 years ago, is that the young Japanese man was played by George Takei. This was before Star Trek, so he was not a big star yet. And now a lot of us know him largely through his social media presence, and he's very politically active in a mm-hmm. lot of progressive causes. Obviously,
he's on Facebook all the time.
All the time. All the time. The big plot point for his character in this episode was, of course, that his father had guided the Japanese bombers to Pearl Harbor. Historically, nothing like that ever happened, not for Pearl Harbor and not for any other attacks as far as we know of. But fear of exactly that sort of thing was why we had all these internment camps during the World War II era. And the individual George Takei spent a portion of his childhood in a Japanese-American internment camp. Of course, actors act and they play characters. That's the whole job. But I had to think this one had to have a particularly personal pull. And for all of us, this isn't that many generations removed.
No.
It's really not. And I was thinking about some of my own personal family story, where my great-grandfather came to the United States from Slovenia, which at that point was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in 1913. So right before World War I broke out. He was tremendously lucky to get out of Europe at that point. And just a year after he came to the United States, World War I started. And by 1917, the United States was at war with Austria-Hungary. And I never remember hearing anything about him being under suspicion or any sort of problems due to his ancestry, or not even ancestry, but he was still a citizen. I think I'm not sure when he naturalized, but I'd be surprised if it was that quickly. Of a country that the United States was currently at war with, and then a generation later, my grandfather, who was born in the United States, didn't serve in the army in World War II, and his draft papers had some sort of medical deferment, which didn't make any sense. if you actually knew the medicine, because that's the sort of thing that people have all the time, and we fix them and then we send them off to boot camp. And what we found out later was that the chemical plant that he worked at was part of the Manhattan Project. And so they were just keeping everybody out of the army because they were doing something else. And just to compare those stories of a recent immigrant experience, or growing up as the child of immigrants, to the similar patterns with people who had come from Japan, the contrast just seems so striking to me. And maybe that's my bit of inherited family guilt, that things worked out for my family the way they're supposed to, and for so many others it didn't.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, it might just be because even though American education hadn't yet gone into the steep decline it would go into later, nobody knew where Austria-Hungary was.
Well, that may be true. That may be true. But what other stories do any of you have about family from that era that might be connected somehow?
It's interesting. The whole story arc for Arthur revolves around his father guiding the planes to Pearl Harbor. And my grandfather joined the Navy in 1938, and he was on the USS North Carolina at Pearl Harbor when it was bombed. He tells us the story that the plane, one of the planes flew so low that he could see the pilot shaking his fist at him. And it is not something he's ever really got over. I mean, why would you? But, you know, about every 7th of December, he gets very, very solemn. You know, it's something that stayed with him all these years later. And I don't think that he's ever fully forgiven the Japanese people for that.
Yeah, my grandfather was stationed in the Aleutian Islands. So he was in the Army Air Corps, so sort of the pre-Air Force. Was stationed in the Aleutian Islands when Pearl Harbor happened. And for better or worse, was in what was considered an essential position, which was that he would every day go out and take a bunch of stuff in a warehouse, out of a warehouse, and hide it out in the tundra so that if the Japanese bombed the warehouse, it wouldn't get destroyed, and then every night bring it all back in so it wouldn't freeze. He was sort of in charge of this chain of warehouses and making sure that those got taken care of. He kept requesting transfers because it was just the most mind-numbingly boring work you could ever imagine, and the government kept saying no. So he basically comes out of the war with no problem really whatsoever with the Japanese, but just loathing the American government. Especially a few years later when Korea started up, he volunteered to go to Korea, and they actually rejected him because he'd already served overseas. Alaska wasn't a state yet, so it still counted technically as overseas service. So that just cemented the loathing for bureaucracy. That said, he still, worked as a postmaster for 50 years, so clearly he didn't hate the income, just the government in general.
Well, any other closing thoughts on this particular episode? It's probably time to move on to the next one.
No, I think we're good.
Okay. Our third episode is Death's Head Revisited. This episode aired in 1959. There are several characters in the episode. It's not a two-person show like the encounter that we just looked at, but it is, if the main character would be not really gentleman, but a character by the name of Lutz, who is now going by the alias of Schmidt, and another person, man by the name of Becker. The story revolves around Lutz going to a concentration camp in Germany. It is 15 years after Nuremberg, or after the liberation of the concentration camp at Buchenwald, and he has gone back because he used to be one of the commanders in that concentration camp. As he is going through and reliving what he thinks are the highlights of his career, he meets one of his old prisoners, Becker, who proceed to talk to him to bring back all of the guilt, I guess, that you could say, that Lutz is responsible for his actions at the camp. And I think I said it was Buchenwald. I think now looking back that it's actually Dachau is where they're supposed to be. So, earlier we had the monsters on Main Street, so now it's my turn to get it wrong. It's Dachau. Anyway, as a result of that guilt and of seeing not just Becker, who, plot twist, turns out to be a ghost because Lutz killed him the night the Allies liberated the camp, the ghosts of Becker and others that died there put Lutz on trial for his crimes and torment him to such a state that they drive him insane in 2 hours. And the end of the episode sees him taken off to a mental hospital. I think that's the summary. Did you have any of you have anything to add to that?
I mean, there's that bit at the very beginning with the, was it the innkeeper?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, who looks at him strangely as he's registering for his room.
Yeah, she's clearly horrified by him.
Right, so it wasn't just the inmates that he brutalized. I mean, clearly he has a reputation in the town also.
I didn't know how much reputation he personally had in the town, or if it was an association that the town knew what was going on and knew he was in charge. Does that make sense?
Right.
Like, how much of it is personal and how much is association?
Right. No, that's fair.
So our title, Death's Head Revisited, comes, or it's a play on the novel Bride's Head Revisited, which I have not read, but I think, Kristen, you said you read it or read some of it.
I read a chunk of it. And I think it's mostly just a play on words rather than deep plot connections. Bride's Head Revisited does start with a middle-aged army captain coming back to a place that had been very significant to him as a young man. And then we go back to the story of when he was a young man and all of that. So I did see some connections there of just the of revisited, I guess, of a middle-aged middle-aged military person returning to an area that had been very significant at an earlier stage of life. But
okay.
I think that's as far as it went.
All right. Yeah, I was not going to tackle the 305 pages, you know, to prepare for this episode of Death Set of Bride's Head Revisited. Yeah. So going back to our title, that Death's Head refers to the skull and crossbones that were used in different sections of the German military, especially in the concentration camps. The literal Death's Head is Lutz, who I guess I should point out at this point, Lutz or Lutze, since his name ends in an E, is a stand-in for Adolf Eichmann, who, if you don't know, he was a leading Nazi official. He escaped to Argentina and then in the mid-50s was found by, I think it was, wasn't it the Israelis, found Eichmann in Argentina, brought him back to Israel. And this episode is actually airing while Eichmann is on trial for the crimes that he committed during World War II. So this is really Serling's chance to really stick it to the Nazis, to be, as we would say in 2016, a social justice warrior. You know, I don't think anyone misunderstood what he was getting at with this episode.
It didn't strike me as subtle, that's for sure.
Right.
No, it was very, very heavy-handed. It was interesting because I saw in Lutz a kind of serial killer mentality. We are not supposed to have sympathy for him at all. You know, in his opening narration, Serling alludes to these, the black clad, I forget how he puts it, but they're dressed in black and strutting about like animals. And then his closing narration says that the Nazis buried their own humanity during the war. So we are not supposed to feel any sort of sympathy or empathy for Lutz. And as he's going through this concentration camp, you know, we have that weird in the corner flashback to what things were like before. And he's this proud individual. He's got wealth. He's got power. And one interesting frame, he mirrors an image of Hitler that is still hanging on the wall, which I don't think that would have been there at the time. But that's, you know, that's another indication we're not supposed to like him. One interesting thing that I saw was that even then they were hammering on the idea of, well, we were just following orders, you know, that the World War II really ended that idea that we can just follow orders and escape responsibility. And one line that stuck out to me is that Becker calls "We Were Just Following Orders" the new lyrics to the Götterdämmerung, or the Twilight of the Gods. Anyway, I guess that's also because I like Wagnerian opera, so that really struck me.
Well, and obviously in this case, he's not just following orders, right? I mean, he
went above and beyond following orders. I mean, it wasn't just following orders. He delighted in the orders he was given.
Right. And even now he's going back and, you know, reminiscing about the good old days when he got to, you know, use the gallows.
Right. It's the opposite of Felton from our previous episode, who had guilt over killing one man who had surrendered. And now we have Lutz, who delights in remembering the hundreds or thousands that he killed. I had written down here that for Serling, this would almost be what we would call today social justice. And I can only imagine what Serling would have been like on Twitter. You know, with his heavy-handed morality, whether justified or no. I just imagine what he would do with a medium like Twitter. Which I did look up why he was able to get this passed, because it does seem like such a vengeance-laden episode. How did he get it past the censors? And it was because he was also listed as a creator on the Twilight Zone. So he didn't have he was able to get more by the censors as he would if it were just a writer or something like that. Anyway, Kristen, you wrote some things down about revenge versus justice. I'd contemplated that toward the end. The character of Becker says this isn't revenge, this is justice. But is it justice to drive him mad? Would justice be, as we did in Nuremberg, to hang them all? Well, not all of them, I think 16 at Nuremberg, but you get the idea. Is his insanity justice? Any thoughts on that?
Well, one thing I was just realizing now, because I totally agree, we are not supposed to be sympathizing with this person at all. He is dressed up as a cartoon villain. And yet, there's nobody doing this to him, actually. That this is all happening within his own brain. So as much as he looks like he's on vacation to Dachau and thinking back on the good old days, he clearly has more guilt than he's letting on, because that's what destroys him. It's everything here is all within himself.
I think you might have taken this differently than I did. I just assumed that there were ghosts there that drove him nuts. Like that he had no guilt and that this supernatural, you know, Twilight Zone-y thing had to intervene, because otherwise he was just going to be, you know, reliving the glory days in his own mind.
And I took it entirely different from both, where because in the beginning Sterling has referred to them as animals, throughout we see his dissension from, shall we say, man to beast. Then at the end, we're told that he buried his own humanity. The question is he even capable of feeling guilt? And is his madness not necessarily because of the ghosts or because of the own guilt he has, but because anyone would even dare to question that he did the right thing?
Oh, interesting.
You know, is he that self-righteous?
Right. Or, I mean, if going the sort of bringing up the animal parallel, is he insane because he has no guilt and he's given up that bit of his humanity so that the rest of his humanity goes with it?
That could be.
I hadn't thought of either of those.
But going back to your initial question, that speech of Becker's, that this is not hatred, this is retribution, this is not revenge, this is justice, that really struck me too, because my goodness, it seems like revenge to me.
Yeah, it really does.
And I'm really not sure what, if this isn't hatred and revenge, I don't know what would be.
Yeah, and maybe, I guess maybe there is a subtle criticism there of that mentality of the, it's okay to do this to this person because he's a really bad guy, so we don't need to worry about things like due process and trials and so on. Which I actually, have either of you seen the movie Judgment at Nuremberg?
No, I haven't.
It's really long, but it's also, it's interesting. It basically walks through kind of a fictionalized version of the Nuremberg trials, which, of course, raised the question of how exactly do you punish someone for this using a courtroom, right? I don't think that question is really anywhere in this episode, right?
No.
The idea that maybe there does need to be some kind of chance for him to give a defense, some kind of chance for him to, you know, explain himself, and all of the other things that you should have in a courtroom. On the off chance that you're actually innocent, none of that is allowed. Partially because he's such a cartoon villain that, like you guys point out, we know he's guilty.
He was set up to fail, but even at Nuremberg, we gave them lawyers.
Right.
True.
You know, the only defense he seems to be allowed to give is we were only following orders, and even then that's set up to fail.
Right. So, yeah, maybe in a sense the sympathy for his character, if there is any, comes not in what happens to him, but in the way it happens to him.
Mm-hmm.
In the you know, sort of heavy-handed hammer of just revenge-filled power that falls on him. rather than, again, the courts and the law and the processes and all of the things that we think civilized society ought to use. But, of course, on the other hand, the camps are anything but civilized society. So maybe by being the warden there, he puts himself outside of all of that.
And then since we're talking about how do we deal with war criminals, you know, this would be a good point to ask, you know, what about war in general? I think it's pretty clear that even though, you know, we were talking before, World War II is supposedly the good war. But even then, I think Serling wouldn't necessarily has some questions that we need to ask ourselves about justice and war. You know, how do we handle our own actions in war? If we had acted the way that if the Allies had acted the way that the ghosts acted, what would the public opinion have been?
Well, do you think he's, again, maybe making the subtle suggestion that they did? Or are we supposed to assume that Serling is just sort of going full moralist here and saying, no, this is, it's right that we're taking this approach?
Personally, if I were to project my own opinion on it and knowing what I know of Serling, I would say that he's going full moralist on it. Just because it's something that's close to him. You know, I think this is something that he personally had a hard time looking at objectively. This was something that he cared about, at least what I could find in relation to this particular episode. Although that is interesting to ask. So you're asking, did the Allies act like the prisoners in the camp or like the ghosts in the camp? Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, I'm just asking, is there an implication that this is a little picture of Nuremberg?
If it is, that's interesting, and that's something that I've been trying to ask myself recently in the last couple of years. You know, we like to say that Nuremberg was, I don't know, not necessarily fair, but we put them on trial. Personally, I wonder, would it be possible for them to have gotten a fair trial? Not that they deserved a fair trial, but would a fair trial even be possible?
Oh, I guess I will come out as anti-Nuremberg, and I will say that it's not the sort of thing you can do in a courtroom.
Right.
I mean, what law has been broken that is being enforced? In that case, you just say, look.
Well, their argument was Kellogg Briand, but.
Right. Yeah, and that's a tough argument to make.
That really is.
So, which isn't to say I think there should have been no punishment. I think there should have been, but it should have been from a position of, look, we think what you did is awful, and there needs to be justice for that. But it's not the sort of justice we can get in a courtroom. It's, you know, it's we won the war, or it's something else. I don't have a good alternative. I think we lose something from the courtroom imagery. You know, I don't know that we could set the ghosts of people who died in the camps on them. Although, again, if Serling might be onto something here, I guess, with his method.
Well, it is good to know that I'm not the only one that questions Nuremberg. Anyway, I do see some allusions in the episode, much like Dante assigning certain people to his various levels of hell sometimes before they even die. He also punishes Lutz, who, as we've said, is the stand-in for Eichmann, who was on trial as this is going. So regardless of how the trial ended, Serling was going to get his, shall we say?
I missed that. Get his.
Get his revenge, or he was going to have his say on the matter, regardless of how the trial came
right.
out. And then, as well, there's. I saw again the imagery, maybe of Poe's Telltale Heart, where you start with someone who has committed a murder, and he seems perfectly normal, and over the course of Poe's poem, goes increasingly insane.
I haven't read that since I was a child, so. I don't have a lot to say about Poe.
Yeah, I agree that the imagery is there. Again, I would just draw the line between the guy and Poe, who it is his conscience that's bothering him, and Lutz, who clearly has no conscience.
Right. I just brought it up as an interesting parallel.
No, but you're certainly right that the descent into madness it looks very similar for both the characters.
Right. The end is in stark contrast to one of Serling's earlier episodes. I think in season one of The Twilight Zone, he did one called Judgment Night, which featured a different Nazi who, I guess, he sunk a passenger ship during the war, and his punishment was to relive the night as a passenger on the ship. And in that particular show, we see that particular Nazi feeling empathy for those that he has wronged. You know, we see trying to stop the outcome. Whereas here in Death's Head Revisited, there is, I guess we'll say, there is no redemption for Lutz. He is doomed to his fate.
Right, and it's lacking that contrapasso in some sense, right? In Judgment Night, there's the idea that he is getting a punishment that fits his crime.
Yes.
How do you punish someone who's responsible for a concentration camp? I mean, what punishment is fitting for that? I don't know, but I don't know that it's insanity. That feels like I think Becker points out that actually the real punishment is going to be divine judgment, which, okay, that is the right answer, but there's also this idea that insanity is somehow a good stand-in.
Right, but that is the right answer, but it's not as if they said divine judgment is coming and we're going to send you there quicker than you might have otherwise. They're just going to drive him insane, which means that for the rest of his natural life, he could be insane.
Right.
You know, it's not the death penalty, it's we're going to drive you insane for, I don't know, how old would you say Lutz is? Maybe 40s? 50s, if that.
Right.
So, conceivably another 40 years of insanity. And then comes divine judgment. I don't see as that.
I mean, I suppose with insanity, there's no opportunity for repentance. I mean, maybe that's the idea, is he's not going to be able to find religion and repent and make up for this. But so now he's, you know, guaranteed divine judgment. But even that's kind of a stretch.
I was going to say even that's a stretch, because if we go from the fact that he has descended, or he is in some way an animal, he would not be capable of repentance. And given his own attitude, I doubt he would seek repentance, because he goes to his insanity believing he's done nothing wrong.
Right.
True.
He is the one who is wronged against here.
Right. Anything to add to that at all?
I don't think I have anything.
Okay. I will say that Serling's closing narration to this episode is one of my favorites, because it talks about why we need to keep the bad parts of history around. I know we brought this up on Monuments and on our Monuments and Memorials episode on Sectarian Review, but the very closing has the doctor who's come to examine Lutz, and he asks why we keep Dachau still standing. And Serling tells us we keep it standing to remember that at a point in history, there was a time that men buried their consciences and acted no better than animals. And the moment that we forget that, then we become no better than they, which is interesting considering the judgment that he passes on Lutz. Anyway.
Right. It's a cautionary memorial, not a restorative or purgatorial one or anything like that.
It is. I just find it interesting that his ending note is to encourage us to do better than they, and yet his episode is based around a group of men doing no better than they.
Right. Well, anything else on this episode? Otherwise, we'll ask sort of the big wrap-up question for the three of them.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything else on this one.
Okay. So to go back to what we started with, what are some of the common themes that we see running through these three episodes? What's brought up that binds them together?
Guilt. I guess in The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, you have, you know, who is guilty, who is responsible. The second and third would deal, how do we deal with guilt?
Right. Yeah, and that's basically what I had, the idea of there being some kind of relationship between responsibility and human nature, right? People have this I guess monster, for lack of a better word, living in us. Right? Mm-hmm. We are by nature fallen and sinful, to use the Christian language. And there's a responsibility that goes along with that, right? That has a real world effect when neighbor turns on neighbor at sort of the first mild inconvenience that comes along, or even the longer term psychological effect, like we see in the encounter, or the ultimate judgmental effect, I guess, for lack of a better way of saying it, in the third episode, when the guy is basically told he's going to go to hell because of what mm-hmm. he's done. So there is I guess a progression of different stages of responsibility and how that flows from who we are. That's not something external to us. It's not something built, something that's sort of constructed and then placed on us. It's from within.
Yeah.
Which I think just shows us what a terrible, terrible place the Twilight Zone is. There's not much room for redemption here, right? We don't really see forgiveness and restoration and regeneration and all of the things that as Christians we think comes through the cross.
Yeah, I throughout these episodes, I kept thinking of Alexander Solzhenitsyn saying how in the Gulag, realizing that the line between good and evil runs through every human heart, and mm-hmm. it seemed that that the first two that we were talking about were all about showing the evil within seemingly good people, and then in the third one, where there might have been some potential to see some good in a person we would perceive as evil, there's none of that. It's everybody is worse than you might think. So I was really interested to hear what you were saying about Judgment Night, but which does sound like it might have been taking a different approach, but we didn't watch that one. So these three are pretty bleak.
and a lot of them throughout the series are bleak.
Yeah, like I said, these are the only three that I've seen sort of in full, so I don't have a sense for a feel for the series as a whole.
I think that in terms of outright happiness, I think there's only two episodes in the whole series that actually give a happy ending.
Goodness.
Like, that's outright, you know for certain, without a shadow of a doubt, that the individual ended up better than they started.
So across five seasons, there are two episodes?
That is a tentative number that I found. Now, there might be more. You know, I guess you could argue others, but like I said, in terms of outright happy ending, I think
Let's assume a margin of error of two episodes. There might be four, right?
Okay.
Wow. Crazy. Well, do we have anything else to add about these three episodes of The Twilight Zone?
I think I have said all I have to say.
With that said, let me wrap it up. Thank you for listening to The City of Man. Our show is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is...
That's me.
For more information about our show and all other shows in the family, please visit christianhumanist.org. Please also swing by iTunes and give us a rating, and stop by Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. You can also reach us by email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.